listener production.
G'day, I'm former police officer Brent Sanders. And for the past 25 years, I've dedicated myself to sharing what I've learnt on the force to the Australian public so they can better protect themselves from falling victim to crime. So with the help of some of the most respected current and former detectives and high-ranking law enforcement agents, I'm going to pull back the curtain on what life is like on the force and what they've learned about how crime and criminals really work. These are real stories from real detectives. This week, a heinous crime which shocked Australia and the homicide investigation that followed.
I stared straight down the camera and said words to the effect as, "We've got your DNA. For the rest of your life, every time you see a police car driving down the street, you're going to wonder whether they're going to turn and come and pick you up."
Mick Simons is the former head of the South Australian Major Crime Squad. After an illustrious career, he retired in 2009 with the rank of Chief Superintendent and as one of the state's most respected officers. To start, we're going back to the 1970s in Adelaide. Mick is a member of the Armed Offenders Apprehension Group, and he's just received a call about a commotion at a gun shop.
You get that dreaded call, comes over, shots fired, Hamley Clark, which was the gun shop, Rundle Street East, man holding hostages. So we scrambled. We went down there. I took up a position across the road from the gun shop, and I could see the gentleman who we now know as Michael O'Connor in the gun shop, dishevelled sort of a person, had a khaki army type jumper on, dark trousers. And he'd walked into the shop. We subsequently found out he'd walked into the shop and taken ammunition, picked up two shotguns and ordered everyone out of the shop and then started firing shots out of the building. There was a young uniformed officer had responded first. He was hiding behind a patrol car, unarmed, in front of the shop and trying to talk to the offender who was ignoring him and then firing shots. We managed to get Brett out of the size and we tried to contain. The normal process we always had in that day was, and it's still the same, contain as much as possible, avoid primary confrontation on the hope that you can wait the person out or talk the person out. This particular gentleman, Mr. O'Connor, and I believe solely that he was a suicide by police. That's what he wanted. And so we were sitting, I was across the road. He was putting ammunition in and he was using solids in a shotgun. Now, a solid is the actual solid round. And when it's fired, it's not a buckshot. It's a solid piece of lead. I still, now as I'm talking, you can recall the sound of the bullets slamming into the wooden partition above our heads where we were across from the shop. They were constructing the car park and it was all had the wooden partitions around it. And you could hear the round guns that had come whistling past and then slam into the back. It was really a crazy situation because we were about 75 metres away from a major cross street called Potney Street. Rundle Street East at the time was a major thoroughfare, and they had this in Rundle Mall, which was adjacent and flowing on from Rundle Street. They had this fashion show, and it was a really festive atmosphere. And it was almost like the Roman Colosseum. We had all these people lined up 50 to 75 metres away from this, in their minds, show, and we had, as I said, bullets flying in all directions. So Mr. O'Connor must have got sick of that particular episode, and he kicked out the window of the shop, and we both, everyone relieved breathed a sigh of relief. We think, oh, he's going to give up. He put the two shotguns down outside the window, crawled through the broken glass and stood alongside the shotguns for a short time, leant down and picked them up, and then turned and started to walk towards the crowd. Now, bear in mind, where he was walking, there was also numerous people hiding in doorways, including police officers. We had the person in charge, he's now passed on, was Cole Watkins. He was in charge of the squad at the time. He called out for us to move in, so we moved in. Myself and another chap, Ian McDonald, ran towards the guy as he was walking towards the crowd with the two shotguns. I called out something that haven't regretted, but I've never used it again. I won't use the words I used. I'll abbreviate them to the extent. I yelled at him, "Don't be effing stupid." He stopped dead, turned around and looked at me and said, "Who's effing stupid?" And brought up the two guns. One was if I recall correctly, one was double, and another one was single, and he moved them up, crocked them under his into his side. To me, it looked like the HMAS Sydney had just turned broadside. I thought, God, here we go. And at that point of time, John Ramson, who's now passed, John had the open authority, if anyone was in jeopardy, to take him down. John fired the shot. I heard it and both saw it, and I still see, as I'm talking to you, the scene. We talk about PTSD, but the scene of the guy's jumper staying where it was and then collapsing on his chest as he went down. Myself and Ian ran up to him, kicked the guns away from his possession, and that was the end of the siege. So it was quite confronting, quite in some stage horrific. That was the soul, and as I said before, I'm quite convinced it was a suicide by police. His brother in Melbourne, I think it was shortly after or sometime after, was confronted by police in an alleyway. My understanding that he pulled a comb out of his back pocket in the dark and pointed at police, and he also got shot and died. So it was an interesting sort of experience that we all go through not every police officer is put in that position, but it's one that you expect and you learn to live with.
It's interesting you say that, Mick. You know, these are situations that police find themselves in. I'd say that there's not too many who probably find themselves as close to an armed offender as you did. And as you say, and I really appreciate how candid you are with this, these things, they stay in your mind. It's as clear to you today as it was standing there. And goodness me, 1976 is a few years ago. And you mentioned also that you would classify this as almost like a suicide via or by the police. You believe without any doubt that he knew that his actions were going to lead to him being fatally shot by the police.
There's no doubt in my mind. I mean, the actions he took, the consistent firing at towards the police, the shots were, maybe they were deliberate. They were not aimed at us. We were hiding down behind, across the road, hiding behind major earthwork equipment. The shots were going over our heads. You could hear them tumble. As I said, he was sort of trying to fire, and the rounds he was firing, you could hear them sort of tumbling before they smacked into the wood behind us. So he was, maybe he could have taken us out if he decided to, or maybe he just said, "This is enough. I want to get out them there." The fact, the way he climbed out of the window, these deliberate actions in picking up the two shotguns and then moving towards the crowd, he'd have to know that something was, and then to turn on me and raise the guns, obviously there's got to be repercussions, and he was prepared to take it.
At the point when you were there and he was identified, or was he identified at the time, did you and others know who you were dealing with?
No, and we didn't know until after who he was. We believed he'd attempted suicide in Victoria prior to coming over. And look, he may have decided to come to South Australia to get his plan done. We don't know. We never will know. But he definitely wasn't known. We didn't know who we had there. As I said, he almost looked like he was homeless, dishevelled, long hair.
And some mental health issues there, which is tragically so often, Mick, you're in the job a long time, you've seen a lot of stuff, and it's often disturbing to see how many folks that the police are dealing with that in behind these dealings are mental health issues that can often then lead to alcohol dependency, drug use, and all these types. It's very, very sad, isn't it, to be fair?
society today has the situations where, in my belief, there's not enough support, both for people who serve, in other words, in police and armed services, as well as the general community. In recent times, you look at the history of people being shot and or killed in recent times across Australia, and there's that always that potential element sitting in the there was mental disturbance, mental illness of some description. They're not all of them are suicide by police, but a lot of them just, they've reached the stage. They've got no, there doesn't appear to be enough services available. Or, on the other hand, the services are there and they don't want them.
Do you think a case like this with this individual, would it be dealt with differently, not better or worse, would it be dealt with differently today than the way that it was dealt with back in 76 with the training or respectfully lack of training that was around there?
Embarrassing, they used to use the video of our action as part of the training program of how not to do it with the new division.
Right. Well, that sort of answered my question, I guess.
It does. And must admit, as being involved in it, we weren't that impressed when they were doing that. But the situation is that these, in Adelaide in particular, in South Australia, they have what they call the Special Task and Rescue Group, Star Force. They do a lot more training than what we did. We have a lot more equipment nowadays than what we had. I mean, we used to just go in. My job was inner containment. I used to have a shotgun. And that my job was the inner circle and try and contain the offender as much as possible. Obviously, nowadays, they have a lot more different approaches. We have a lot more technology and things like that. So answer to your question is they would handle it a lot different to what we did. But we did what we were trained to do at the time. And, I mean, I went, thinking back, I would have been in half a dozen, maybe a dozen incidents in all the time I was there. That was the only one that ended in that sort of circumstances. And sadly, the people that fire the shots, they don't get over it. I mean, John had, he's passed now. John was affected by it. And another one, another gentleman I know that had to do a similar thing, he was really affected by it. So it's not easy for us. I still get flashbacks with that. I get flashbacks with others. But you learn to live with those. You do learn to live with them.
So, Mick, following something like this, which is a police shooting, which is a fatal shooting, of course, the police go away. And as you said, back in the day, the debrief was perhaps a couple of beers and a bit of chat. There would be some internal, external investigation take place, some sort of coronial inquiry following this. Can you just explain what happens there?
In that sense, it'd be regarded as a death in custody. So there is initially an investigation by an independent group within the police, and that investigation is then provided to the coroner, who can conduct, it was a male in those days, so the coroner would conduct his own inquiry, review the evidence, and if need be, he would call witnesses. Then the coroner would make an adjudication on the events before him and reach a determination. In this particular case, he determined that the actions taken by the police were justified.
Mick, in 2003, you were the officer in charge of the major crime investigation branch there in South Australia. And in that role, you oversaw the investigation into the murder of Samantha O'Reilly. Just wondering if you can outline your involvement in this case.
Yeah, we go back to January the 3rd. I was actually in Rundle Mall shopping and got the phone call that there'd been a body found in an area that's called Humbug Scrub, which is about 25, 30 k's out of the centre of Adelaide. And my role as the officer in charge would be to attend the scene along with my operations inspector and the major crime team that was on call at the time. So we went out to the area in Humbug Squad and located a body lying on the side of a road leading to a farmhouse. The body was of a young woman, difficult to tell her age at that point of time. She was as if she was placed there because her head was on her arm, not as if she'd been thrown out haphazardly. First thing we noticed looking at her, well, she didn't have anything on the top, but her pants had been put on the wrong way, inferring definitely there'd been some form of exposure of her body. Ants were starting to crawl into her. We made some inquiries with the house down the street and found out that the most the lady could have been there would have been 15 minutes. The farmer had driven down the road at about 5 o'clock and come back at 5:15 and found the body. So we were fronted with the body sitting there or laying there, and we started the normal thing. You contain the scene, start working on the various avenues of trying to get people in. You bring in the forensic thing, you bring in Dr. Roger Bayard was the specialist from the forensic area at the time. So the body at that stage, the lady appeared to be about 18 to 25 years of age. So we started to make some inquiries. We had a patrol in the area going around down at a place called Blakeview, which was about 12 kilometres away. And they were flagged down by a gentleman saying he was looking for his daughter. And he gave the patrol, asked them if they'd seen anyone, and then he gave the patrol a Polaroid photo of a girl, which they brought up to the scene, and we then realised it was the girl that he was looking for, Samantha O'Reilly. Now, Samantha at that stage, I think, was around 15 years of age. So we had Samantha identified. And this was a really interesting matter, and I'm going to touch on a few things of how, I dare say, and I use the term the old days, how we could have been sidetracked on a number of occasions. And that's what I found interesting about this particular case. The first aspect of it was what I call the Chamberlain syndrome, based on Lindy Chamberlain. Everyone expects, when you deliver news to somebody, everyone expects a sort of a reaction that you believe is correct. It's happened to me quite a few times as police. You know, you give someone bad news and they sort of look like they're smiling, or you tell them something and there's not the reaction that you think should occur. So you start to get very suspicious. And that was a situation. We went to the house of the family at about 1:30 in the morning. And we, I was with my John Ventito, who was my ops inspector at the time. And we sort of sat down. And these are really a difficult thing. We used to always try with murder victims that we knew who they were. We used to always try and go together where possible to talk to the parents or the survivors and try and sort of get the places with our victim contact officer and a few things in place. But we walked in and father was very sort of, his comments was it was Samantha, the one on the radio, because there'd been radio broadcasts about it. The reaction we got wasn't what we expected. The primary content was a comment, well, I guess you'll never be a Queen Scout. The brother was there, the younger brother. He appeared to be very furtive. There was no emotion being showed. It was almost as if they were indifferent. So you start to think, well, hang on. Are these in the frame? Is the reaction what we expected? If it's not what we expected, do these people become suspects? They were confronted and questioned in the course of the investigation. They obviously denied it, and they were never involved in it. We set up a major operation, calling in people from all directions and having police officers doing door knocks and setting up a mobile command area. In the course of the discussions with the father and the family, they sort of, as an aside, mentioned they were not happy with Samantha visiting a young lad across the road, a lad of about 17 across the road. And they said, well, his parents aren't there. The father was quite adamant about the potential involvement. So we think, suspect number two starts to roll into the frame. This gentleman calls into the command centre at about 1 o'clock in the morning and says, oh, it's a bit sad about Samantha. What are you doing? Now, at that point of time, we'd never released the name. And we go, oh, righto. We made some further inquiries about his movement and found out he'd taken his car to a service station shortly before that, steam cleaned the engine and the back seat of the vehicle. When we questioned him about that, he said, oh, he might want to sell it. So once again, that was very, why is this happening? Why is he making inquiries about Samantha when he shouldn't know about Samantha? We had difficulties with that. He was 17 years of age. His parents were in Tasmania. He contacted them and said the police were trying to talk to him. They had immediately insisted he had to have a lawyer present and we couldn't talk to him at all. We found out by talking to the patrols that despite our requests, one of the patrols had told the gentleman that it was about Samantha. So there was the first break in that situation. He had been told by police. Subsequently, we did find out that he was intending to clean his car. So in the course of the investigation, he slipped off the radar as well. We really put a lot of effort into publicising the murder. We followed up sex offenders in the area, looking for them. We went onto the media. We pushed the media initially with daily updates. We provided them access to the scene after that. We did a reenactment of Samantha in the shopping centre where we understood where she'd been. She'd been to the Blackview shopping centre. And she used to go there quite regularly. She used to go down there and have a look at the shops, and she had this dream in her mind that to get married and get married in Bali, so she'd spend time looking at the bridal shop there. We continued to push it really hard and using Crime Stoppers as a medium. We did a door knock. We started to do circles moving out from the location of their home and from Blakeview, trying to follow up with a template question and answer. So the amount of material we gathered was just horrendous. It was just so difficult to cross-reference, but everything was put into case management, and we moved forward using that material to try and get some nexus of where we could find out more information. We then moved to primary suspect number 3 was a call from Crime Stoppers. This lady said that she saw a man in a car with Samantha sitting alongside of him at about 4 o'clock or 4:30 on the afternoon she went missing. The car was parked on the side of the road about a kilometre from where the body was found, and the car had a distinctive fur dashboard cover. So we made some inquiries around the area, and one of the teams came back and said, look, there's a car matching the description. It's in a property down the road, and that does have the fur cover. We made some inquiries about who was there, and we found out that at the house, the guy had a small zoo. And he used to get scraps of food from the greengrocers and from the shops at the Blakeview Centre where Samantha was last seen. And he was at that shopping centre on the afternoon that she was murdered, and Samantha had been seen talking to him previously. Samantha had a fascination with animals. So we spoke to the gentleman, and he declined to answer questions, immediately lawyered up. He didn't go into a lineup. And I forgot to mention previously, we did have, as part of the forensic analysis, we had DNA, and we had ideas of how she was murdered. We moved forward on that with the assistance of his lawyer, and eventually eliminated him from the inquiry, but he was a real hot suspect at the time. One of the primary methods of investigation, this one, was a concentrated media strategy. I fronted up as the media on a daily basis. As part of the strategy approach to that was that we would reveal tidbits of information to keep the media interest and generate further information coming in. The DNA we had on the body was sperm on her around her navel area, There was also other forensic evidence we'd obtained as well. One of the other points we didn't mention was the cause of death was strangulation. That was never mentioned at any time at all. So we then went on air, and before we did that one, there'd been a change in the law in South Australia which allowed mass testing of DNA for specified purposes, and this fell within the specified purpose realm. So we started moving away out from the victim's house and targeting people for testing, moving on a strategy at that stage of anyone within the vicinity would be tested. But prior to that, we also obtained a list of people that she may have known as well. And one of those persons was a gentleman called Mr. Hender. He was coaching the young boys' football team, and he'd also been in the house fixing up a washing machine. We moved forward on the strategy, and I upped the strategy after discussion where I stared straight down the camera and sort of said words to the effect as, we've got your DNA for the rest of your life. Every time you see a police car driving down the street, you're going to wonder whether they're going to turn and come and pick you up. Every time you hear someone knock on your front door, you're going to wonder whether it's the police come to arrest you. Because I can assure you, and I'm paraphrasing, I can assure you that we will be there. We will get you. Now, we had taken his DNA as part of that initial structure. So we took his DNA on the 19th of April 2003, some 3 months after the murder, as he was a known associate of the family. That was when that same day that I'd done the broadcast about, we're going to come and get you. At the early hours at 2 o'clock in the morning on the 20th, I received a phone call from Wallaroo Police, which is about an hour and a half out of Adelaide, saying, we've got this gentleman called Hender. He's just tried to commit suicide in the middle of a paddock, but he's failed. He sent around and he said, when they pulled up, he said, I'm sorry, I strangled Samantha. Now, bear in mind, we never released the cause of death. So he was taken to the cells, alerted the team, and they went up and questioned him. He made a full confession. I spoke to him and he said, when I heard you say that what was going to happen with the DNA, he said, I just couldn't live it anymore. So we then went through the process of the court process. He claims that he saw her walking along, offered her a ride back home because she knew him. She willingly got in the car. He took her to his house, tried to rape her. He panicked and thought she would tell about it, didn't know how it would cover. So he strangled her and then took her up and dumped the body. So it was an interesting case in the sense, and that's a very harsh word, I suppose, to use for a murder inquiry. I think murders are the most horrendous crime that really scream, and the victim screams from the grave for some form of justice. And there's too many out there that don't get that justice. So in that situation, we had, as I said, four potential suspects we could have gone down the path. And if it wasn't for DNA, back in the good old days, you may have finished on any one of those with circumstantial evidence as being enough to push forward. But we took, in that particular case, we took 150 DNA samples. And to me, it's a compelling argument for the use of DNA in investigations where possible. Mr. Hender is still sitting in incarceration. He was sentenced in 2004. He's got 23 years non-parole. And we're now waiting to see what will happen to him as his parole period comes up.
You said that you leaked certain information to the media, and then you later mentioned that one of the things that the offender said with regards to strangling Samantha, that was not something that you had ever mentioned to the media. So when you're leaking information to the media, there's a strategy behind that too, isn't there, with regards to an investigation?
In this case, and in all cases I was involved in, there was always a documented media strategy. We discussed with the team what we would say, why we would say it, and what was the hopeful outcome of that. And we didn't mention, the other thing we didn't mention, that was a rope was used. And when he made his confession, he said he'd use the rope, and we actually found part of the rope that had been cut off, that had been used. She also was wearing one thong, and he told us that he'd thrown it in the rubbish bin. We did, and we didn't. We weren't successful. We tried to locate that thong as well. The confession was only part of it. I think that's important for people to understand. Just because somebody says, I did it, doesn't mean they did do it. There are a lot of reasons why people may give a confession. Could be their ego, could be some reason, could be a mental reason for it. So it's you can't close the thing down if somebody says, it was me, lock me up. You need to be able to prove what that person is saying, and that's part of the questioning technique by experienced detectives, that they cross-verify information. We know what happened. Can this person independently tell us what happened?
Would there ever be a strategy, Mick, where releasing information to the media, you may release information which is not strictly correct that you can then pick up on when somebody is being interviewed because they are just parroting back what they've been told through the media and you know that that's not actually strictly correct? Would that ever be a strategy?
I wouldn't regard it. And the reason I wouldn't do it is it goes back to a lady called Lindy Powell, who is still a very active QC in South Australia, or now senior counsel in South Australia. Linda used to hold her thumb and forefinger about an inch apart, and she'd say to me, you give me that much room and I'll drive a double B truck through it. So to do what you're suggesting is giving her that much room. Oh, you lied about that? What else did you lie about? So it's a strategy that I never considered. I can't speak for others, but based on that wisdom provided me many, many, many years ago by Lindy, no way you would ever leave the room for the double B truck with her coming down driving it.
That's a great analogy. Now, Mick, you stepped away from the job in 2009. There's a figure that you mentioned, which is quite astounding. You'd estimate that during your time in the job, investigating and overseeing investigations in senior roles, that you had involvement in over 3,000 investigations, and that's a huge body of knowledge and skill that you take with you when you leave the police in 2009. Mick, I'm just interested, if I could, in asking you, since leaving the police, have you continued to work in roles where those skills that you developed over that time have come to fruition?
Well, I left South Australian Police, or SAPOL as referred to it, as in 2009, and then I stopped with ICAC until 2011. I left the New South Wales ICAC in 2011 and commenced my own company with the strange name of Anti-Corruption Consultants Australia, or ACCA. And since then, I made a conscious decision that I enjoyed what I was doing in the police and ICAC, and that was investigating matters, not necessarily catching people, but that was a good bonus when that happened. But I enjoyed the investigation, this is going to sound crazy, the thrill of the hunt, the capture of the quarry, or the resolving a matter one way or the other. So I've continued along that frame since 2011 with my own company. And I've been lucky enough to have been involved in a number of areas. My first overseas jaunt, for want of a term, was a part of a review team for the Investigation Unit, Office of Internal Investigations in the United Nations. My role as part of the team was to review the investigation processes. I've been lucky enough to get involved in various review, not necessarily investigations. I wound up in Serbia for 6 weeks, part of a team out of America, looking at the introduction or assessment phase of anti-corruption agencies. I spent some time in Bangladesh, and that was looking at the police integrity unit there. They have a team of 400 officers, and their job is to, in covert manner, to observe their fellow officers as to whether or not they were engaged in corrupt conduct, such as taking kickbacks or being bribed not to take action on things. I spent time in Bhutan training the unit there on anti-corruption investigation and anti-corruption prevention, or corruption prevention methods. So all in all, it's been quite interesting. And then I'm still working and investigating various matters. At the present moment, I've got a procurement matter on the table that will run into about $25,000 worth of potential fraud. That hasn't been finalised yet. Doing an audit on a compliance process for procurement and some general matters considering bullying. The skill base that you learn as a police officer or have as a police officer, don't toss it away because it's something that you learn, you work with, and other people can benefit from it.
You know, I've spoken to police who are recently retired who would take real benefit from hearing what you're saying, because I think many that do leave the job dramatically underestimate the skill set that they have developed through the job and also underestimate the crossover of those skills. Now, of course, not all listening in would have attained the lofty rank of a chief superintendent or could put their hand up to say that they've been involved in over 3,000 investigations. But having said that, a lot of the skills that you gained would have been back in those early days in the job too, interacting with people and communicating with people. And then as you get further up the ranks, it becomes more focused on investigative skills and then anti-corruption and things. But they all sort of fit in together, don't they, Mick? And every police officer, whether they've been in the job for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years or 20 years plus, is developed skills that can carry over into other environments.
Well, one of the most primary skills that any police officer develops is the ability to talk to people, the ability to obtain information, to make decisions. I mean, that's one of the key aspects of policing. You have to make a decision. And you might make the wrong decision, but at least you've made a decision. And that, I believe, is one of the best skill sets that you can have. And even as you move into a different life, you know, what am I going to do now? Police officers have the ability and the training to be able to say, well, I'm going to do this. And they can approach something in a more positive sense. There are some instances, obviously, where there's a lot of doubt, depending on what happened during their career. I do note from various Facebook groups I'm on that there is still a lot of, there's people out there that are not happy with what happened to them. And they let that become their focus rather than what they can do, not what happened to them. And if they focus on what you can do and what skill set you did retain, it's a lot more positive rather than the negative approach to moving on.
Mick, thank you for the many years of service to the great folks there of South Australia. And thanks again for coming in. And I do really appreciate you having a chat to us.
Oh, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Crime Insiders Detectives is a listener original production. It's hosted by me, Brent Sanders, produced by Ed Gooden, and sound designed and imaged by Link Kelly.